drew you. It's not a cry that you hear at night. It's not someone. Good evening. Welcome to Conscious Living Radio 100.5 FM in Vancouver. I'm Tasha Sims.
And I'm Mark Caron.
And I am so lucky that I made it here tonight. I got trapped in my underground.
Yeah, I'm lucky too.
You're lucky that I made it?
Of course.
Okay, I need to do a big shout out to my cab driver. I had to abandon my car in this underground parking lot, flag a cab that was immediately there like magic, and this incredible Persian man, Bijan, shout out to you. Thank you so much. He drove like Superman. I have never seen, I swear, like I didn't look up. I didn't really look at the road because I knew I'd panic, but he was like flying, like amazing. So thanks. Thank you so much. You saved my career. Anyway, you would have done fine without me, but oh, I was stressing.
We're always glad to have you here, though.
How are you, Mark?
I'm great. You know, it's been an interesting week. Full, lots going on. You ever have that feeling when, you know, you've got so much going on and you feel like you're really busy and you look at your productivity at the end of the day and it's like, what did I actually accomplish?
Usually when I've binged on Netflix, no. Yeah.
So anyways, you know, at least I'm making progress one day at a time. It's all good.
Okay, well, we're talking about yoga tonight, the deeper dimensions of yoga, how to practice, how to access that depth. Our guest is Zamir. He's a yoga teacher. He's committed to inspiring others to embrace the depth of yoga. He's completed his 500-hour teacher training with David Goulet in chakra yoga, who learned from the late Swami Jitananda, founder of Ananda Ashram and proponent of Rishi culture, Ashtanga Yoga. Oh my gosh, that was a mouthful. He studied meditation and Buddhist logic for the past 8 years. He teaches workshops and classes in Vancouver, and as well as the lead instructor for the yoga teacher training program at Langara College. Welcome to the show, Zamir.
Thank you for having me, Tasha.
Last time I saw you, we were doing Teen Journey.
Yes, that was many years ago.
How many years ago was that?
Maybe at least 8 years ago.
Crazy.
Now.
Crazy, because yeah. It feels kind of like yesterday, too, at the same time. We had 60 teenagers at Sajak Ranch doing all kinds of seriously cool things. I mean, you were cool back then.
It was their rite of passage, right?
It was rites of passage, and they did, did we do a sweat lodge? No, we didn't, but they did fire walking and breathing and lots of sharing. It was really a remarkable group, actually. Like, it imprinted on me. And the cool part is seeing them now.
Yes.
Like, I keep hearing stories about, oh, someone's in Cirque du Soleil and someone, you know, all these teens who were teenagers, and now they're actually like having these incredible lives, these adventures. It's so cool.
That's what happens. They grow up.
They grow up. As do we all.
As do we
all. Hopefully. So let's start with your love affair with yoga. Tell us about it. How did, I know it's a part of your background, but how did you embrace it and how do you live it with integrity?
Well, those are big questions. You know, for a long time, I sort of felt that I was born in the wrong era. You know, I loved ancient things. I loved ancient Chinese. I loved ancient Indian culture. I often was drawn to Sufi poetry, things that are not really practiced or discussed or embraced in the mainstream. I felt sort of anachronistic. And so, you know, my love affair with yoga, I think, really started, I would say, around the age of like 20 when I started becoming interested in spirituality. And, you know, what the yoga tradition offers is a quite a disciplined and holistic and very rich and very, very tradition of truth seeking. And so when you become a seeker of truth and you want to know some of the deep questions in life, who am I? Where did I come from? How does this work? Where are we going? the yoga tradition has thousands of years of lineage of people who've been asking and engaging and answering these questions and helping mm-hmm. you find a way and how you can make it real in your life. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of where my love affair with yoga began, is mm-hmm. when those questions started to rise mm-hmm. for me.
And what's happening in the current culture, I mean, yoga's kind of, for some people, almost a form of a workout. Like, yeah. it's become so trendy and it's what people do. But do you think there's a missing component? Because the depth that we're going to talk about tonight, do you think that it's relevant, that it's not necessarily a part of everyone's practice? Is there like a disconnect because of that?
Yeah.
So tell us more about that.
Well, it's hard for any one person to tell the story of yoga and how it came to be today. But one of the ways in which I've understand the progression is that there was a very remarkable teacher named Krishnamacharya who had studied traditionally yoga, spent a lot of time in the Himalayas with his guru, and he was a master of the different branches of the yogic and Vedic sciences. It was happening at a time in India where there was a rise in interest in physical culture, like health physical culture, gymnastics, weightlifting, that kind of thing. And so to repopularize the interest amongst Indians in yoga, he had a group of people that were performing yoga postures and asanas. Mm-hmm. And through the display of the physical prowess, it captured the minds of the Indian population again. Traditionally, a yogi was someone who was sort of a renunciate, someone you might see dressed very funny or in the side of the road or in the caves. And these people started bringing it more into the mainstream because it reflected this interest in the growing physical culture. Mm-hmm. So some of his main disciples became like Pattabhi Jois or BKS Iyengar. These were some of the teachers who really popularized what became known as Western yoga today. And it was largely because it showcased the physical prowess of this yoga practice, mm-hmm. particularly a branch of yoga called Hatha Yoga. And Ha means sun and Tha means moon. And the root of Hatha Yoga is using these physical practices, working with this muscle systems, organ systems of the body, working with the breath to activate the psychic centers so that we would be able to live with a balanced state of consciousness, and then a higher level to work with what's called prana or chitta, or energy and consciousness. But it's physical based. Mm-hmm. And so this kind of physical based yoga started to spread. And of course, it was more easily adapted in the Western world because it didn't require an adherence to a spiritual belief system, to a religious belief system, in order to practice it and experience mm-hmm. its benefits. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can experience profound health benefits in yoga without adhering to any spiritual values. And there's nothing wrong with that. However, the aspect of the yoga that you would be practicing is primarily asana and pranayam, which are two aspects of these, you know, in this system, I'm talking about the eight limbs. It's just a branch of it. So what's happened is we've taken off a little piece and we've mm-hmm. called it mm-hmm. the whole. That's the only disservice right. that's happened.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. We're going to get into those eight limbs after in the second half of the show. But I'm wondering, in terms of yoga's power to generate health and to keep the mind sharp and the body sharp. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that? What do you think obviously you're working and conditioning your body, but what is that combination between breath and some of the postures that invites a kind of flow, or like how do you perceive the system helping you heal?
Helping you heal. Well, in terms of healing, I mean, what the yoga practice, yoga is primarily understanding energy. It's an energy-based viewpoint, right? Mm-hmm. So the potency of yoga is that the way that the postures and breathing is designed is it works on a subtle level as well as on a gross level. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the understanding or advances in healing arts now are showing that a lot of illness originates on the subtle level, on the level of the mind, on the level of the emotions. And so yoga can help to do this, particularly when it's practiced in a more meditative way. it becomes a literally like a movement mindfulness practice mm-hmm. that can create that. Mm-hmm. As a result of that, what's happening is you're seeing a very significant reduction in the stress levels. And so how the body works is that when you're experiencing stress, adrenaline is being pushed out to the extremities of your body and your immune system gets suppressed. Because the body, evolutionary speaking, we would have a stress response if there was some threat to our life. Now we're having stress responses to everything. Mm-hmm. So what's happened is that the stress response is getting way overactivated in the human body. So a good yogic practice can help reduce that stress response and then allow your body's natural healing abilities to take place. Many of these asanas, because of the way in which you position your body, can actually work on different meridian lines. It works in different internal organs. It works on different endocrine glands in the body. So even if you don't have an awareness of all these benefits, they're happening. Mm-hmm. Now, if you wanted to get more into a therapeutic application of yoga, then you would develop more knowledge of how these system of breathing exercises and asanas work to deal with specific conditions arising in the body. And this is yoga therapy. It's very possible to do this.
Mm-hmm. You know, the part that always... lands for me is to be present and aware of your breath. Your focus is inside. It's not outside of yourself. Just that one basic directional piece around perception, I think, is the beginning of changing everything, because you're now actually examining a terrain inside of you where you do have some domain over if you're working with it. Whereas if you're looking externally and trying to make any changes out there, it's sort of the wrong direction. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And yoga is trying to point you to that direction of turning inwards.
Right.
And so when you have learned a basic sense of how it works, and you're able to, in a fundamental level, it's a command and mastery of your attention.
Mm-hmm.
And when you know how to actually harness the power of your attention and direct it consciously with a particular intent, whole other world's open up for you, because otherwise we've been basically on autopilot.
Mm-hmm.
And yoga is trying to say, like, actually, you know what? Autopilot's okay, but if you were to have it put back in your hands, boy, you can fly this ship and have a lot of fun.
And have fun doing
it. And the
idea
is that this body and mind is an amazing vehicle. If we know how to work with the energies, you know, we can have a lot of fun. We can enjoy it, you know.
You want to jump in here, Mark?
You want to jump in there?
I always want to jump in, but the conversation's so great that right now I'm happy to listen.
So, okay. I want to hear a little bit about what influenced you to, and I know you studied these Buddhist teachings.
Yes.
With my
guru, Wisdom Master Matikantin. You didn't mention her in the intro, and that's fine.
It's
quite a long one. Yes, Wisdom Master Matikantin.
I thought I did well.
So Matikantin means it means generous giver, and I owe a tremendous, tremendous debt to my guru, because you see, what is given to you is a treasure that's so precious. I mean, what is the value of truth, of true knowledge? I mean, when you lose all the falsehood starts to go from your life, you realize how precious truth is, okay? Mm. And this is somebody who is giving you the true knowledge, whether it's comfortable or not, and many times helping you to see the parts of yourself that are false, that you don't want to see. And they're dedicated to giving that to you, regardless of whether you're going to kick and scream and squirm and whatever, right? But if you keep coming back, they know that you're actually sincere. You're for real. Okay, that's mm-hmm. the work of the student, sincerity, willingness to apply, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the guru provides you with that gift. And so anything of any value that I have now in any teachings, anything that I say, I mean, really, it's the gift of my guru that's helped me to see that. Okay, I've done some work on my way, but it's different to have someone that you're working with rather than it's just intellectual. Like what the guru helps you do, you can get a lot of things out of a book. I mean, I could recite book knowledge to you, and some of it I will. But what the guru does is, but how much of it can you live? How much of it do you practice?
You're challenged.
Yeah. What's real for you? Let me see. Right? Mm-hmm. And they can test you because they live it. And mm-hmm. so they know when you're talking, they're like, yeah, I know you can say this really well, but I know what it feels like. And you I want you to display this to me. What is your understanding? And they'll test you. You'll see.
So we were talking about this before the show started, this whole concept of guru and follower versus student and disciple and everything else. And you were beginning, because we were, you know, we come at it from different places for sure. And I said to you, I'm not a great follower. And I'm a good student, but I'm not a good follower. Mm. Meaning I don't, when something is true, I open, and I don't mind being challenged either. I quite like it. But this, for me, the word guru means I have somehow attributed power to somebody other than, as if they have more direct access to this field, whatever you want to call it, than I would. And that feels off to me. That's not saying they don't know things I don't know or that people aren't trained in areas. Not at all. So I'm not trying to be arrogant. I'm just talking about access to the divine, I think. The place where I get disturbed or uncomfortable or find a sense of unease is when someone says, I have a direct channel. Maybe I can teach you and maybe you can work your way up to it as if it's a hierarchical pathway. But there's something about the model that is, we're not, as if we're not all the same. And I guess I really feel as a value we are. And therefore, if one has direct access, so does the other.
Sure. I mean, any true guru, I mean, my teacher always teaches us that you are divinity wearing a body. You, the same divine spark of consciousness within you is the same, not just in any human being, every sentient being in life. This is what makes life sacred. Is that we all share this spark of sentient consciousness, this pure awareness that exists within all of us. And the teacher doesn't really seek to lord it over you. Of course, anyone in any position of power can abuse it. Doesn't matter what it is. I mean, I know you've practiced as a therapist. People come and they have an issue. They should be able to figure out their own problems. Why should they come to a therapist for advice or guidance?
I don't give advice. I will facilitate their experience of their own wisdom.
Yes.
That's the difference, right? Now, are you saying a good guru is doing that? Would be doing that?
Now, remember, a student is coming to a guru because they want to be able to embody the consciousness that the guru embodies. They have to learn. They want to learn. Yeah. So if you're coming to a guru because you feel like, well, you know what, I would feel really good to be in a place where I was just subservient to someone. Well, that's not what it's really about. That's not what it is. And someone might see that in you and it might feel good to them or it might serve their purposes. So they'll say, sure, yeah, you can do whatever I want, you know. But that's not the true guru. That's somebody
who's... So define it. Maybe enlighten us a little bit on... especially, I like the metaphor you started with before we came on air. You were talking about a mother. I like that metaphor.
Give
us that.
Well, I was saying, you know, at first thing that, you know, in the context of a guru, you're not a follower, you're a disciple. And what does it mean to be a disciple? It means to uphold a certain discipline. When you want to learn a way of life, that's what a guru is imparting you. You know, when a child comes into the world, they're discovering how to be in the world. Now, as a parent, you can help them. You have to help guide them to a disciplined life, right? Because there's so much possibility, and you don't want to restrict it and tell them, no, this is how you have to be and who you are, but the consciousness itself needs to be able to find maturity. And to find maturity, the first thing is we have to be able to discipline our energies on some level, to discipline our thoughts, to know how to act in a way that's harmonious and is leading towards growth and harmony and enhancement. So the guru is really, you know, someone who you're coming to saying, I really want to grow up. I want to mature spiritually. And the guru is saying, okay, so like you're this tree, now let me help you see how to prune yourself a bit. They don't want to restrict your wildness, your inherent nature, but they want you to find the freedom that is within you. And I use the thing mother because I was saying that, you know, if you had a mother, someone who said, well, you know, I don't want to have a child because I don't want to be a servant of a child. Not knowing that many times when a mother is supporting a child and giving to a child or loving a child, she's not a slave to the child. It's because there's a love bond that's there. She's helping a living being to grow, right? Mm-hmm. Now, a guru is doing the same thing with you, but without the all the emotional attachments that come with a mother. Because if your mother was to be your guru, you'd go insane. Your mother is your guru to a certain point in life. They give you unconditional love, but they also can coddle you. They'll give you the things that are not always for your best growth. They'll project their own unconscious aspirations for you, the things they want you to be. The guru doesn't do that with you.
Some gurus don't do that.
Some gurus. But I say my guru, and I think a guru worth their salt, what their goal is for you to be independent to the point where you can fly on your own.
And here's the piece when you were talking about mothers. There are mothers who say, the child says, why? Why should I do that? Whether they're being defiant or not. I don't want to. Why should I? And the mother replies, because I said so. That energy, if you transplant that into a, to me, that's what I have seen with gurus and students that I object to, because I said so.
Yeah.
As opposed to the child goes, why? And the mother might ask a question that would illuminate a reflection for that kid to actually examine the choice. And maybe experience the consequences of a different choice. Like, there's many ways to support the empowerment of a person. And one of them is dogmatic, and the other, to me, is not. The other is fluid, that completely allows your spirit, you know, waters the seed of your spirit to answer your own question.
Mm-hmm. I like what you're saying. In principle, it's very true a lot of the times. But remember, if you are, my guru doesn't really get any financial benefit from me being a student.
Right.
You know, the beautiful thing is that it's almost like they have an independence where it's like they don't have to be someone that you're going to hire and go to someone else. No. That's not how it works.
You don't do courses. You're not being charged.
No, it's not like that,
okay.
Right? So, of course, I would do a work study at the monastery, or people would come and they would pay to stay at the monastery. Many of the courses are not charged, and there's a nominal fee for a year to get things sent to you. But the whole point is that there's an independence. Because if you're paying someone as a contractor, you expect them to treat you a certain way. You expect a certain result. Now, that messes up the whole relationship between a guru and disciple, because now they're in your hand. The whole thing is that you can come, you can go. You like what I give you, great. You don't like it, go. If this hurts your ego, too bad, go find somewhere else. And you know what? If you're really sincere, you'll realize that they told you what they needed to tell you. And sometimes they need to say, hey, listen, this is how it is because I said it is. And the ego's like, no, I should be treated differently. I need a different explanation. But later you realize that that was the truth. It's a very tricky line, because a guru can really abuse their power. Now, if it's someone with sincerity and integrity, if you're that fortunate to find someone like that, then you're blessed, because it was designed in the yogic culture where there was integrity between the gurus and disciples. We're talking about a time where there was a more purity in the consciousness, that it was one of the most valuable things you could have in life. I mean, somebody who just can be that role for you. You know, it's such a gift. We wish we had someone in our life like that, right? But it's been abused a lot now, so it's given it a bad rep. But the purity, the essence of the relationship, the capacity of what it can serve will never change if it's upheld with integrity. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful thing. I'm not a guru, by the way. You know, I'm a student. And in the context of yoga, yes, I'm teaching as a yoga teacher here in this culture, largely because I think there's many things that have happened in my life that have led me to go to certain places, pilgrimages, study with masters, that many people in this environment would not go to that length.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like a bridge. You know, for those who are not going to go to the mountain, you know.
They can come to you.
They can come to me.
How does a person decide, or who decides somebody's a guru?
Well, usually the master will declare themselves as a master, if they're a master.
Oh, they declare themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. They'll say, I'm a master. I've realized.
That was a great question, because it was kind of my question as well. So my question to you is, as a bridge, do you think that some people that you might teach or share or impart your wisdom that you've learned might perceive you or see you as a guru, even though you do not see that as yourself? Because gurus just...
They might, but I would be quite clear in the beginning of any kind of program or instruction, like, this is my guru, this is the knowledge, and this is how I've learned it, this is what I've heard, I'm passing it on to you. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not a guru, I'm not here to take disciples, and I have no intent. I'm telling you, it's not a job you want. I mean, I've seen it. I've seen my guru, I'm like, the more you, over years, you're like, this is such a tough gig. People project all their stuff on you, they want you to fix their problems. I'm like, it's not an easy gig, trust me.
You're talking to the initiated.
Yeah, exactly.
Projection out the wazoo. I'm so, it's hard.
It is.
To be.
No intent.
So the reason I did ask the question, though, is about perception and not of you of yourself, but of others of you.
Yeah.
Because it's, in regards to your question, Tasha, like, who declares who is the guru?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because mm-hmm. if I see you and I'm learning from you and I see you as a guru and are in a guru type role, then that's a perception versus a master calling themselves a guru.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
I think, though, the teacher or the master or whatever you want to call them, the person with the knowledge, when people do begin to abdicate their own responsibility or their own power, there's a way to illuminate that too.
Yeah, of course.
Right?
Yeah, I do think that there is a way to do it. And it's almost unavoidable that mm-hmm. for someone to do it. I've done it with my guru, you know, and it's part of your own, it's a part of your own learning. At the end of the day, the seeker is the sought itself. It's the same thing. What you're looking for is within you. You can go all over the world. It's right there, but you have to find it out yourself. Nobody can make it happen.
I'm laughing because you've just cued in our song. We have to take a quick break. We play a piece of music all the time. No, Inner Ninja. You just cued it.
Oh.
You're listening to Conscious Living Radio 100.5 FM. We'll be back and we'll talk about your workshops that are coming up and the eight limbs of yoga.
I broke the chains before they choked me out. Now I pay close attention, really learn the code. I learned to read the map before
bounce
I hit the road.
I know you never heard this before, but I'd rather lose a fight than miss the war. And I ain't wishing competition or fishing for it. I'm just living in a system, conditions are poor. I've been lost in the rhythm and misinformed. Too many late nights hitting the liquor store. Too many bad decisions, half-ass attempts. No sweat, no fear, no blood, no tears. I go hard, and I ain't making up no excuse. I'm overdue, I don't do what I'm supposed to do. Cause if you think about a man, we're supposed to lose. It ain't all picture-perfect ocean views. Nope, I was a first-class rookie, taking out bullies in my all-black hoodie. Man, a mystery, you know the history. Get it or forget it, cause poof, I'm out of here.
I read the rules before I broke them. I broke them.
Uh-huh.
I broke the chains before they choked me out. And I paid close attention.
Come on.
Really learned the code. I learned to read the map before I hit the road.
Hey, yo, I've been high and I've been real low.
Yeah.
I've been beaten and broken, but I heal though. So many ups and downs, roughed up and clown. We all got problems, but we deal though. I'm trying to do better now, find my inner peace. Learn my art form and find my energy. When my back's on the wall, I don't freeze up. Now I find my inner strength and I re-up. Here we go. I know I never been the smartest or wisest, but I realize what it takes. Never dwell in the dark, cause the sun always rises, but gotta make it to the next day. It's a feeling that you get in your lungs when you run, but you're running out of air and your breath won't come. And you wheezing, gotta keep it moving. Find that extra and push your way through it.
I've had bad habits, but I dropped them.
Drop.
I've had opponents, but I knocked them out. I climbed the highest mountains, I swam the coldest seas.
Woo.
There ain't a thing I've faced that's been too much for me.
My inner ninja, my inner ninja, my inner ninja, my inner ninja.
I've had bad habits.
We're back. Conscious Living Radio, 100.5 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Tasha Sims.
And Mark Cron.
And we're talking to Zamir. Are you like one of, like Prince? You don't have a last name?
You know what's funny? I feel like it, at some point, if I say anything that's worth quoting, it might just come out as Zamir. But it might take a while before I get there.
No, I like it. I looked at that and I went, no last name in the bio. This is good. I think it's good. I probably wouldn't be able to pronounce your last name anyway. So Zamir works for me. I like it. So I know you've got an event coming up. I want to make sure we really invite people to join you. Let's give them the dates, first of all, and then we can break down who it's for. And
It's a 20-hour training. It happens two weekends in March, March 9th and 10th and 16th and 17th. And it's in Vancouver at some two beautiful places. One is a center that I've been teaching at, two centers I'll be teaching at. One is Bridgen and Rich, another one's at Langara College in the Broadway campus.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And we've got all the information for people who want to register on our website, www.consciousliveringradio.org. And you'll also have it where?
At my website, zamirdanji.com.
Perfect. Oh, now we know your last name. No, now we know your last name. No, being an idiot. Okay.
I prefer the word silly, Tasha.
Silly?
And I like silly. Silly's fun. It's playful. It's a great way to live.
You're contagious, Mark. I think that's where it comes from.
Well.
Okay. Eight limbs of yoga. Because, I mean, what makes your practice unique and different would be this, right? This system. So maybe you could break that down for people.
Well, it's certainly nothing to do with, it's not what makes my practice unique or different. You know, a couple of things. One is that yoga is a catch-all term that we say for going to a studio and doing some stretching, but you know, it's been around for thousands and thousands of years. There's many paths of yoga. So there's the three main paths. One is the path of service or karma yoga, path of action, jnana yoga, the path of wisdom or knowledge, and then bhakti yoga, the path of devotion, right? And then you could break it down to different aspects, different kinds of yogas that are more specific in terms of the sadhanas or practices, you know, that people do. Mantra yoga, pranayama yoga, laya yoga, these kinds of things. But the thing with yoga, it means union, right? Or one of the terms is integration. So it's yoga. Any yoga is a path that you walk to help you realize who you are as pure consciousness, to unite with the essence of who you are. So the eight limb system was codified by a rishi about 2,000 or 2,500 years ago. We know very little about his life, just that he was absolutely brilliant. He composed a treatise on medicine, one on grammar, and one on yoga. And the one he did on yoga are called the Yoga Sutras. Sutra means it's a woven thread, because that's the way it's structured. The interlocking logic and consistency of his explanation of yoga is beautifully woven together like a necklace, a thread that you'd wear around. And the Yoga Sutras are a concise mapping of the territory of yoga. It's a blueprint and architecture to understand the journey of yoga, the journey of the consciousness, the layers of consciousness, how we would move through this journey with a sense of confidence and clarity of what lies ahead for us. So this is what he provided in the Yoga Sutras. It's basically just truth bomb after truth bomb after truth bomb. They're quite cryptic because they're very terse. I mean, you could fit it on four pages.
Like, give us one. A truth bomb. I love truth bombs.
So he defines, he says, Yogas chitta vritti nirodaha tadadrashtahu svarupe vastanam. And that means that yoga is the cessation of the fluctuations of the field of mind. Thus, one beholds one's true nature, or the seer becomes visible to oneself. So this is what he says right in the beginning. This is what yoga is. Now, very intelligently, he doesn't say yoga is union. Because if he does, that becomes subjective, not scientific anymore. It's poetic. He's not poetic. He says, yoga is that which is not. That which you identify with is changing. That thing which stops changing in that state, that is yoga, because in that unchanging state, you will realize your unchanging nature. Then you will realize it, right? So then he say, okay, now how do I do that thing? How do I stop it? It's na 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 na. Now, what's fascinating is within yoga, this Raja Yoga is based on something called Sankhya philosophy, which understands, we can't really go into it here, but essentially what Sankhya philosophy helps us to understand is, what is the relationship between spirit and matter? What is spirit and what is nature? And it views the consciousness as an evolutionary process. And from primordial matter evolving all the way down to our actions of the physical body and the senses. And when we, what he's helping us to do is understand how this whole thing is manifested and how to trace it back bit by bit, bit by bit, bit by bit. So all these things that we identify as, oh, this is me and this is why this happens, and he helps you to withdraw from it to see the deeper causality and the deeper causality and the deeper causality until you come to the primal cause itself. And there's a deep liberation in that. Each time that you pull back and you see what is behind the apparent reality, you get an expansion of your consciousness. And that's what he's helping us to do, expand the consciousness.
That's so interesting, because when, to me, I would use different words. I know exactly what you're talking about, the layer behind the layer behind the layer, and all of them go in.
Yeah.
And then at the end, there's nothing.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
There's nothing, and there's everything. It's everything.
Sure.
And it's nothing. Ultimately, yeah. Right? Which again sounds like words, but what you're offering on the weekend and in your training, will it be an experience? Is that
so? I'm calling it an embodied philosophy training, because when you normally study the Yoga Sutras, you know, you sit with these sutras, you'd read it, and you try to contemplate it. Most of yoga, most of Raj Yoga, I mean, most of it happens sitting down. Even the term asana, which we have as the catch-all for all these postures we're doing, the way Patanjali uses it is just your seat. That is what your asana is, okay? Uh-huh. To practice yoga, you need to be able to sit like this. If you can do this comfortably, that's all you need for yoga. You don't need to contort yourself in any other direction, okay, in the purest sense of the
right,
word.
Right.
Because he's saying, to understand your consciousness, you don't need to stand on one foot.
Right.
You just need to be able to sit comfortably for long enough, then you can see how the whole thing works. Right, that's his view, right? Now, you do all these other postures partially for working with the energy if you're doing hatha yoga, but largely so that this thing doesn't become an obstacle and a disturbance, because otherwise you can't sit still for 5 minutes. How are you supposed to understand how your mind works if your body is not even comfortable for a few minutes? That's a reality for most people. So in the embodied aspect of the training, what we're going to do is through the breath, through the movements, to really be able to explore and apply some of these principles. For example, in a well-constructed asana practice, you might explore dharana, which is concentration, or pratyahara, which is withdrawing your senses inwardly, possibly entering into dhyana, which is an uninterrupted flow of thought or contemplation. You can explore these things through an embodied practice. Some of the basic principles of yoga, called the yam and niyam, the restraints and observances, you can explore nonviolence through your relationship with how you treat your body. You can explore things like, we might say, satyam, truth, by the way in which you recite a mantra of words that are just only purely truthful. There's ways in which you can construct your practice where you can integrate the teachings of the eight limbs. And then the other thing that we do is some exercises that teach us how to contemplate correctly. Someone can give you a profound E equals MC squared, but if you don't know how to unpack it, what does it mean to you? So the idea is to give people ways in, how do I unpack this, so that it becomes resonant in your life.
Is it important, or is there value doing this in a group, in
yes,
a collective?
Absolutely.
What
the way
that
this, the way, well, the way this training is designed is, there's a beautiful quote by Einstein. He says, "The field is the sole governing agency of the particle." Okay, so we never exist in a vacuum. When you're in a group that has a sankalpa or an intent for our spiritual advancement, and a willingness to see the parts, the deeper layers that are there, it creates an integrity and a support in the field where that can happen more easily for you than if you just read the book at home alone. And the way that the exercises are designed is to harness the power of group intent, to harness the reflective capacity that another has, because any individual can be your guru in that moment. And so we're going to use the collective in a way where we can really enrich our exploration of it.
Who is this for, this training that you're offering?
For people who are interested in a deeper understanding of yoga philosophy, for people who have maybe gone to yoga classes, done the asanas, but feel that there's something more behind the practice than what they're being fed in, you know, an average studio, and potentially for teachers, people who have, who are teaching yoga, who have done a teacher training, and they want to be able to impart some of this to their students because they know that there's more, but to do it in a way where they can integrate it into themselves and exercises that they could apply. Be great for someone like that too. Any of those people.
And so it's four full day trainings over 2 weekends here in Vancouver. What would you say in terms of preparation? Is there anything, or could a beginner, someone who doesn't have a lot of experience at yoga but maybe is listening to this and thinking, okay, I'm curious, I don't know a lot, I'd like to know more, but perhaps they don't have a practice, would it still, are they still welcome?
Absolutely. And one of my favorite Zen sayings, in the beginner's mind there are many possibilities, in the expert's mind there are a few. So one who comes with this, I know all this yoga stuff, they will be more limited. If you're a beginner, it's perfect for you. I mean, the way we're going to do the physical practice won't be too challenging. Of course, there's always modifications. But if you're a beginner, the most important thing is sincerity and an open mind. Then it can seep into you, because you are not, you could spend lifetime studying Patanjali. I feel like an infant when I study him, you know? He's just so vast, so profound in intellect, not just beyond intellect. He's realized these things. So, you know, you don't come expecting that, oh, in 2 weekends, I'm going to get the whole yoga download. You are just going to be introduced to something profound that you're like, okay, now I'm interested. I want to learn more about yoga, which is really, I want to learn more about who I am.
Right. And for people with limitations, with illness, with just who are not, that's kind of where I was going with the beginner ideas. There's all kinds of people who aren't versed
physically
in the
physicality. Physically, it won't be strenuous. Okay. If there are things that you can't do, then I'll know and I won't make you do them.
You'll modify.
We'll modify it, or you can, you know, sit out. I seemed like Mark had a question.
Well, yeah, I kind of did. First off, I think, you know, this is a great entry level for anyone who wants to know more about yoga, because, you know, you're covering these eight limbs, and there's so much yoga, which is kind of what you were touching on just a couple of minutes earlier. You know, we're such a hotbed of yoga here in Vancouver and in the West, the way it's exploding. Why do you think we're not including all of this in some of that mainstream teachings and yoga practice?
And maybe just run through them. Can you quickly? Do we have time to name the eight limbs?
Yeah, I can name the eight limbs and then answer your question.
Yeah, please.
So the eight limbs are the yama, which are the restraints or a moral and ethical behavior. The niyama, which are observances, also along those lines. Then you have asana, which is poses or physical postures. Pranayama, which is the enhancement or practice, conscious practice of breathing. Then you have pratyahara, which is the withdrawing of the senses and learning how to turn inwards, and also control and mastery of the senses. Then you have dharana. Dharana is a concentration, learning to focus your mind on a single point. Dhyan. Dhyan is contemplation, or developing an uninterrupted flow of thought or awareness. And then samadhi, which is oneness or integration, which is the state where the separation between observer and observer is dropped, so you can experience that reality.
Oh, cool.
So these are the eight limbs that are constructed by Patanjali. And in terms of why this is not being integrated in a lot of yoga classes, because this takes, first of all, you can't just cover it in a 200-hour yoga teacher training. The requirements for someone to be a yoga teacher in this culture is different from how it would have been previously in India. Yeah. Nowadays, if you want to be a doctor, you don't just do it for 200 hours and say, I'm a doctor. There's a lot of things you need to learn.
Absolutely.
So, but the bar for being a yoga teacher in this culture is exceedingly low. Not to criticize yoga teachers. There's some great ones out there, and there's many aspects of how Western yoga is helping people to find some reduction of stress and increasing health and awareness in their life. But that shouldn't be the cap, the limit of what yoga can offer. And that's the reason why it's like that, is because yoga training is quite limited in nature in terms of what they explain and expect the students. Most of the people who are teaching people to become yoga teachers are not grounded in this knowledge. Mm-hmm. They don't know how to teach it. Mm-hmm. To teach it, you have to study it. You have to learn from those who have also learned and realized. Mm-hmm. Those people are hard to come by. It's not easy to come by those people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I find this knowledge to be so precious. You know, it's a gift of Indian culture, not just the physical postures. And the real gems of yoga come from the depth of the wisdom that has arisen through the consciousness of these sages who sat uninterruptedly with pure consciousness, with intent for the good of all, to bring forth truth that will liberate other people from illusion, from suffering, from ignorance, so they can find peace and harmony and unity in their life.
And how do you, Zamir, integrate that on the daily? What's the most profound impact that all of this study has had on your practical life?
On my practical life. So when I wake up in the morning, the first thing I do is meditate for up to an hour. When you are steeped in this knowledge, you start to realize the power and value of meditation. And the gateways of what meditation can be open up to you. Probably one of the most practical things, it might sound impractical, but practical things, is that it gives you confidence in the goal of yoga, which is to realize who you are, to embrace your divinity, to realize that oneness. I mean, I really credit that to my guru, but studying it and applying it and practicing it, you start to realize these things are true. It's not just in a book. Mm-hmm. This person's not just saying it. I can experience that.
Yeah.
That is who I am.
Yeah.
Now, that changes your whole way of approaching life. When thoughts come into my mind that are complaining, I can cut them off. When a story arises that I'm projecting on someone, I can drop it. Why? Because I know this is just a compulsive habit of the mind.
Right.
So I can see mind for what it is. Now, if you can see mind for what it is and start to see everything is originating from mind, all of a sudden you start to be able to develop detachment in your life. You can let go. When you start to realize how you can use the energy of your body to actually propel you in the direction of where you want to go, you will do practices so that you can manifest what you want. You can create it from within you.
Mm-hmm.
You have that potency, that power to do that, right? So in terms of the yamas and niyamas, it shows me basically that there's a certain standard of ethical conduct and moral living that if I don't adhere to it, it's not about being good or bad. My ability to maintain a quality of consciousness that helps me to maintain calmness and equanimity is compromised.
Right.
Because if you're lying, then you're always worried someone will catch you. If you're violent, you're worried someone's going to do something back to you. How can you be peaceful?
Well,
you have to live according to certain rules.
And the essence of it all, at least for me, is this awareness of connection, that we're all the same and that we're all connected back to that. And I heard a really cool little piece in quantum physics where when they were talking about entanglement, I think it was Greg Braden was talking about it, and he said entanglement is that whatever was whole, even if it's broken apart, the connection between those pieces is never severed.
Absolutely.
So that you can have, that's why prayer works, and you can have someone at one end of the world and someone at the other, and yet they're still communicating. And so when you take that concept and you say that's all of us, like not we're all the same except for him or her, or that bad one over there, right? Which creates that polarity of good and bad. When all that's dissolved and you go, we are all the same. Not our personalities,
yes,
not our egos,
right.
but the life force,
yes,
is the same life force.
Yes.
It's really hard then not to, even the basics, to, you know, walk by a person in need, because that's you. Like, we're all connected. That piece, I think, changes, for me anyway, how I live my life or perceive my life, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, I love everything you've been sharing tonight. And again, just tell the folks the dates so they can come and do more.
It's March 9th and 10th, 16th and 17th. You can go to the Conscious Living Radio website or come to my website, zamirdanji.com. And it's not a full day. It's from 11 to 5, so it's a bit more of a gentle day. People of all backgrounds are welcome to attend. And, you know, we already said the kind of people who I think would be interested in it. Fundamentally, there should be a hunger for some of the deeper teachings of yoga, mm-hmm. regardless of your physical capacity. Because if you want it, then you're going to be excited by what you encounter. And when you're genuinely excited about material, you apply yourself to it. And when you apply yourself to it, you get a lot out of it. What you give is what you receive.
Right.
Yeah.
Final wish for the world. It's always the thing I like to wrap with. From your heart to the world, just from a heart-based place. What's your wish for everyone out there listening?
I say sarva mangalam, which is all beings. I experience that auspiciousness. And what is auspiciousness? It's a feeling of specialness, this specialness of life, this gift, you know, the realization that life is a gift. And what you give back to it is your gift to life. And when if people get to see the preciousness of this life, of this body and mind, I want people to feel like I want to grow and expand within it. I want to know its full potential. I want to give with the fullness of my heart. That's my wish for people.
Beautiful. Thank you so much
thank
for
you.
Joining
thank
us.
You
You're
for
a gift.
Me. Thank you. Thank you so much
also,
for having me on the show.
That was fantastic. And yoga's one of, you know, my favorite subjects.
Mm.
Now it needs to be a better practice of mine because I'll be honest that I'm not always
you should go.
On my game. I'm going to be out of town for half of it is one of my issues there. But I just love the way you're bringing in the full aspects of yoga and what you're doing, what you're teaching, and your energy is just always a beautiful thing to be around. So thank you so much for being you and being a friend.
You've been
listening to Conscious Living Radio 100.5 FM in Vancouver, Co-op Radio. I'm Tasha Sims here with Mark Caron. And we'll catch you next week, next Wednesday, 6 to 7.
We're going to sign off with Believe from Shawn Mendes.
To hold you back, doesn't have to pin you down. Let your dreams take flight in your heart, ignite. Did you know that it's true? Follow the stars, forget about the past, that it's over. We are the young ones, our way is forward. Who keeps tabs on stupid mistakes?